This is my daddy's sermon, Waking Loves and Lord's Prayer. Enjoy it.
Have you ever heard the story of Rip Van Winkle? It's a story of ouches. So I want you to practice with me this morning. Say, ouch. Okay, good. Now when I say ouch, you're going to say,
ouch.
Got it. Okay, good. So as this story goes, Rip Van Winkle was born in a family of nobility, a family of character, a family of courage. And in early America, the Rip Van Winkles were known for this solid character in their own community in New York, upper New York. Then the narrator in the story tells us this great family line, this great history and honor, Rip Van Winkle did not inherit those genes. To which you reply, then the story tells us not to fear, though. Rip Van Winkle is likable. He goes throughout the town. He plays with the kids. He is a great teller of stories. He tells ghost stories and stories about cowboys and Indians. Not only is he good with the kids, but he's good with adults. He has gossip sessions with the guys over politics and what's going on in the early republic called America. And not only is he good with kids and with the guys, but he'll go hunting and fishing with anyone. In fact, he doesn't even care if he throws his rod in all day and catches nothing. He's content with whatever life gives him. Good old Rip Van Winkle. But of course, here comes one more time. The narrator tells us Rip was ready to attend to anybody's business but his own, to which we reply, his own fences weren't mended. His own farm wasn't tended to. His own children, he had a son and a daughter, were not given any time of his because he was so busy out in the community, being a free spirit in this community. And of course, this makes someone, let's just call it the domestic partner, very unhappy. And she says this, his wife kept continually dining in his ears about his idleness, his carelessness, and the ruin he was bringing on his family, to which we say,
ouch.
But this, it even gets worse. Morning, noon, and night, her tongue was incessantly going, and everything he said or did was sure to produce a torrent of household eloquence. Wow. Then, in response to these lectures, Rip shrugged his shoulders, shook his head, and cast up his eyes. To which I'm going to ask you for a little more audience participation this morning. Let's get our Rip Van Winkles on. So turn to your left or to your right, shrug your shoulders, cast your eyes up, and give your best Rip Van Winkle to your spouse or to someone next to you. Ready, go. Why are you giving it to me, to someone else? Yes, so Rip Van Winkle, we got it. Shrugging. Okay, we got it. So this habit of shrugging, of moaning, of groaning, of not listening to his wife, of not taking care of his family business became habitual to him. And one day he decided, I can't take this anymore. I'm going out into the woods. So he took his wife, rifle. He took his best friend in the world, his dog, and he went to shoot squirrels. It got late in the day out in the woods, and he decided, I don't got much to look forward to. I will stay the night in the forest. And late into the night, some strangers come to visit Rip Van Winkle, and they bring to him a keg. Now, in case you're following this story, nothing good can happen at this point in the story. And that they tell him, now, Rip, you cannot drink of the magical juices that flow from this keg, to which we all know what's going to happen. Rip drinks and drinks and drinks. He can't control himself. And before he knows it, he drinks himself to sleep. He finds a little cave. Ouch. Thank you, Larry Sweeney. He finds himself a cave to sleep. But when he wakes, his body is aching, his gun is rusted, and his dog, the only good thing he has going for him in his life, is gone. He walks into the town, finds that the same mountains are there, the same river is running through his town, but the houses look different. The bars are in the wrong places. And then he goes to his house. It's falling in by now, of course. The farmland is in ruins. He walks into his house, and the poster he had on the wall of King George is now replaced with the poster of General George Washington. You see, because Rip Van Winkle slept for 20 years and missed the American Revolution. To which you say, but not only did he miss the revolution, he missed the opportunity of raising his kids. He ran from his wife and all his responsibilities. He missed the opportunity of seeing his friends go into battle and being a part of what it could be like to be a new democracy in America in this small town. He missed out on life. But the real tragedy of Rip Van Winkle is not that he fell asleep for 20 years. It's that he never learned to live. You see, even when he was awake again and came back into the town, he went back into his same patterns, gossiping with the guys over politics, hanging out with the kids, shooting marbles, telling stories, nothing of value or meaning. Rip Van Winkle was perpetually asleep. The saddest thing about life is not falling asleep. The saddest thing in life is never learning how to fully live. Heart and eyes awaken to the beauty and love and family and meaning and purpose all around us. And so we can be easily lulled into mediocrity. It's easy for us to settle instead of strive. It's easy to let the slow creep of cowardice decay our courage. To which we say, but in the church, around Christmas time, we have a season we call Advent. It's from the Latin word Adventus. It means coming. It's a four-week period of time where we slow down. It's a period of time where we prepare our hearts. We wait expectantly to remind ourselves again of the King of Love, to remind ourselves what was meant by that baby in a manger in that no-name town, in that no-name world, who would set into motion the transformation of the world. In Advent, we open up our eyes with the hope, the expectation of seeing God in new ways. In Advent, we look again at the center, at the core, at the beauty of the Christian story, at the beauty of the carols that we love to sing so much. And this Advent, for the next 3 weeks, we look at the Lord's Prayer. We look at this poetic prayer in order to refuel our fire, in order to see again, in order to live with new passion what it means to call ourselves Christian or Christ followers. And then we deepen our perception and we begin to see ourselves in this story. We begin to have a new sense of oxygen, a new sense of passion, a new sense running of electricity running through our body of what it could mean to be a Christ follower in the 21st century in Rifle, Colorado. We learn to flood our imagination with hopes and possibilities and dreams and visions we never knew were possible. That's what happens when we begin to open our eyes through the season of Advent. And as that sun sets on the end of that season, a new year begins. That's why the Christian calendar starts in December, so that we are prepared for the new year among us, for the King of Love who came in a manger. And so, in that same spirit, we don't merely want to be people who are mediocre, who just survive and not thrive. So we want to study the Lord's Prayer. We want to take it apart. Every single piece of that poetic prayer is filled with meaning, overflows with meaning. From the word Father to the word Your Kingdom Come, all of it. We could spend 10 weeks on a sermon series, but we slow down and spend 2 verses this week, 2 verses next week, and then 1 verse, and then we walk into the Christmas story for the 18th and the 24th. And so in that same spirit, we want to study the Lord's Prayer like Henry David Thoreau studied nature. We want to study it, to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if we could not learn what it had to teach. And not, when we came to die, discover that we had not lived. We do not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did we wish to practice resignation. Read Rip Van Winkle. Unless it was quite necessary. We wanted to live deep and to suck all the marrow out of life. To live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life. Henry David Thoreau meets the Lord's Prayer. So we slow down and we take it verse by verse, image by image, that this incredible prayer, because many of us have said this prayer, if not just every week or every day, we've said this prayer our whole life. So it's time for us to get at the heart of what it means, to rip it apart, to open up these images to our mind and to our imaginations. Some of us are new to saying this prayer. And so we hear afresh what the depth of the meaning of this prayer has to offer our life. So with eyes wide awake, not wanting to be like Rip Van Winkle, we remember and pray together that first prayer, our Father who is in heaven. The first image is that of a father. Now, it's very interesting. In early Christianity, they spoke Arabic in their tribes and in their villages. Arabic was the language before the Greco-Roman world took over and they began to speak Greek. So father is also Abba. Abba means dad. So in the earliest versions of Christianity, like the version that comes right here from Galatians 4, 6, and 7, and because you are children, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into your hearts crying, Abba, Father. So you're no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, then also an heir through God. When we cry from the depth of our heart, Abba, Dad, Daddy, it's a sense that we're trusting in the parental care that God covers our life in. There's a sense that we are putting ourselves under this God who loves us like a parent. It's a sense of immediacy, a sense of closeness. In English, we don't typically anymore call our dads fathers. We typically say dad or daddy when they're younger. And this is helpful for us. Father meant Abba, dad. But of course, in this metaphor of father, there's more. There's a sense that God's parental care also, it's bigger than just the attributes we associate with father. It also has a motherly concern to it. So this Abba contains both a mother and a father. It's the parental care. And this verse is really helpful to us. James 1, 17 through 18 says, every generous act of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. In fulfillment of God's own purpose, God gave birth to us by the word of truth so that we could become a kind of first fruits of His creatures, of His creation even. So interestingly, early Christians understood there's a Father of lights and there's a Mother in God who gave birth to us. So when we say Abba, we're declaring that God is not only Father, but God is a Mother. God is the parent of all of our life. But this has even more resonance in the Bible. To say Abba is to decry the creator and sustainer of life. It's to decry the source of life, the very source that energizes our very being. And it's to tell us that God is the householder. The Bible was written in a time and period where they had households. So your uncles, your brothers, your sisters, your cousins would all have a plot of land. And the plot of land would be assigned to all. And the responsibility would be to take care of that plot of land, to raise the crops, to raise the livestock, and everyone would participate, from the smallest kid to the elder in the community. And so early, the Bible is an agricultural book, and it talked about God as a householder. So to say Father, to say Abba, is also to say, God, you're the householder of us all. You are the householder of the cosmos. Every family is taken care of by your great and loving hand. So Father, there's a few things to think about there. And then, who is in heaven? Heaven is simply the abode of God or the home of God, the source of authority. So when early Christians saw the world and when they decried our Father who is in heaven, they were crying, this is the God of all gods. This is the creator. This is the realm of life where there is harmony and perfection. Early Christians were influenced by Plato in the sense that the heavenlies were, that was where perfection came from. And we'll say more about that when we get towards the end of today. And then the second thing we pray together, hallowed or holy be your name. This word hallowed is strange. It translates, we talk about hallowed ground, a sense of sacredness in the ground that we walk. And we've all experienced that, right? A place where we've been in, a moment where we've walked into a sanctuary, a cathedral, or even a place of nature that we've said, This is sublime. This is hallowed ground. This is beautiful. And so the other moments that I think about this morning are, I think a hallowed ground that we experience is the birth of our children and our grandchildren. When that baby is born and fresh and in your arms, after all that pain and all that difficulty, to hold that baby is to be, in a sense, in a holy moment on hallowed ground that the Father, the Creator of all, has given to us. But there's the second sense of holy in the Bible, God's presence and liberating will in the midst of distress and a persecution. You remember that great story, that call of Moses, where Moses sees a bush ablazing, yet it was not consumed. So it's this blazing internal fire of a bush, but it's not being consumed. And then Moses said, Moses says to it, there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame out of a bush. He looked and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. Then he said, come no closer, remove those sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is hallowed ground. Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I've come down to deliver them. So when we say, hallowed, holy be your name, we are talking about God's character, God's identity. God is the God who meets people in their distress and delivers them. God is a God who loves the stranger, the outcast, the heartbroken. God is a God who gives us these moments of spectacular beauty with one another, the birth of a child, a moment on a mountaintop, alone, away from all. Hallowed be the name, the character, the identity of God. Then, the King James says, thy kingdom come, or your kingdom come. Hear the sense of urgency with the verbs. Come, hallowed be your name, the kingdom. Now remember that at this point in history, there's a lot of kingdoms. There's the Romans, there's the Greeks, there's the Persians, and there's the Babylonians. These great kingdoms represented power, victory, and might. But the irony, the mystery, the beauty is that the kingdom of Jesus comes in a baby, in a no-name town, in a no-name village with suspect parents, right? So the beauty is they have turned upside down what we thought about kingdom. And if you remember, in chapter 12 of Mark's gospel, Jesus is headed towards the cross. All looks dull and dreary, and he's getting confronted by all the religious leaders in his day. A scribe comes up to him and says, what is the greatest of the commandments? Jesus replies, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and all your soul, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus puts together the Shema of Israel found in Deuteronomy with the Levitical law. Jesus is the great innovator of human history and says, your love for God cannot be expressed without love for people. Jesus decries that this little baby, this movement that has began, it's a movement of love. It's a revolution of love to the world. So your kingdom come is this passionate plea that loving kindness, that grace extended to everyone, come down upon this earth. It's about forgiveness. It's about sacrificial service to one another. It's about loving our enemies, or those people that get underneath our skin at times. Your kingdom come is a bold and courageous wake up kind of call that we are called to be people of love. Love cats, if you will. And then your will be done. This is another. Your will be done. Notice the verb, that strong of get this done right now. This is a sense of this urgent, passionate plea that the world needs to be changed. Will is God's sort of eternal intention, or the purpose that God set into motion long ago. And what Jesus did, it's hard to wrap our heads around it, but once we do, it's mind-blowing. Jesus said that with that baby, in that no-name town, in that no-name village, when that baby came, it set into motion the revolution of love. And as the tidal wave of that love begins, It sets a fire. It reaches the entire world. It's the already and the not yet. We live in the midst of the days of the kingdom. And by our actions, by our love, we bring the kingdom here upon the earth. So will, or intention, this is God's desire to make a new world. We've talked a lot about not being otherworldly Christians, but this worldly. We want a Christianity that brings peace, harmony, loving kindness to this world right here and now. That's the way of Jesus. And then this means everyone overflowing with blessings and love. This means no more heartache, pain, and poverty. We're not there yet, but we're working for that day when we can celebrate with one another that no one had a need among us because all of us took serious the call of Jesus to build a new world here and now. And then the verse says this, as above, so below. And it's this interesting image of pull the heavens down and make it upon this earth. So the idea here is that if the heavens represent that platonic perfection, that beauty, bring that beauty down to the earth so that all of us can celebrate the kingdom has come. A kingdom very opposite to the kingdoms of Rome and Greece and Babylonia and Persian. A kingdom based upon love. And then Galatians. And because you are children, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into your hearts crying, Abba, Father. So you're no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, then also an heir. This great Abba, this parental God, has called you a child, has called you an heir. You're a part of the story. Your life, your actions, everything you do brings heaven to earth, brings the kingdom come, allows the will to be done. We find that in praying this prayer, we find ourselves caught up that we are a part of this great, beautiful story that started long ago with a small baby and culminates one day in a world of joy, a world without tears, a world where love reigns triumphantly. When I think about the Lord's Prayer, I'm stuck once again on that great band, Mumford and Sons. And I can't stop thinking about the song. They take a refrain from the psalm, awake my soul. They make it slow. They let us think about it. And they have three images of eyesight throughout this great song. They tell us, and Mumford does this. They mix up metaphors. So awake my soul is the prayer. It's the hope. The confession is, my eyes are not quite right. You'll hear it in the song. And the last thing is, lend me your eyes and I'll change what you see. Advent is a chance for us to change what we see, to look deeper into the Christian story, to milk from it all that it has for our life. So I can't say Mumford and Sons without letting you hear this great song, letting it move you deeply. So I invite you to the Awake My Soul by Mumford and Sons.
How fickle my heart and how woozy my eyes. I struggle to find any truth in your lies. And now my heart stumbles on things I don't know. My weakness I feel I must finally show. Lend me your hand and we'll conquer them all. But lend me your heart and I'll just let you fall. Lend me your eyes, I can change what you see. But your soul you must keep totally free. Ha, ha. How fickle my heart and how woozy my eyes. I struggle to find any truth in your lies. And now my heart stumbles on things I don't know. My weakness I feel I must finally show. Heart, 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 heart. In these bodies we will live. In these bodies we will die. Where you invest your love, you invest your life. In these bodies we will live. In these bodies we will die. And where you invest your love, you invest your life.